In designing today's program, the team really tried to put together a list of very experienced speakers who were speaking on strategic, tactical, and yet very practical tools of the trade. We really wanted to present to you a full, well-rounded day that you could take something back from each and every speaker. We just had our speaker on sustainability, but now Alex Brown would like to provide a very insightful presentation on how project charters can bridge cultures. And yes, we're focused on global today, but I do believe that this is something that you can bring back and start working with your organization today. If you take the time to think about Alex's presentation, I think that you will find it very insightful and something that you would like to bring back as a best practice to your organization. Alex Brown is a PMP. He's the current manager of the Strategic Planning Office at MSIG USA. But in his part-time, in his other time, he does help other firms solve their real-life problems because he's president of his own company called Real Life Projects. He's spoken at three of the last PMI Congresses, and in 2002 he presented at the PMI Symposium. He's spoken before at our New Jersey event. He has many newsletters that he would like to offer to you today, and he can also be reached through his website at alexbrown.com. He's been a project manager for software development and financial services since 1993. I've known Alex since he's presented here, and I've really always found his talks interesting, but in being his angel for this session, I found it something really interesting, and I think it's a testament to his project management skills. I might embarrass him, but Alex also has 7 children under the age of 13. So let's put our hands together.
That never fails to get a reaction. She's with the kids. That's where my wife is. I want to talk to you today about two of the most political words in any language. And as a father of 7, I really know this. The two words are yes and no. If you can get those two words straight in the language of anybody you work with as a project manager, you will have a huge step up over most project managers, over most business people. These are key words. You may say these sound like very simple words. Why would we have any issues with them? Well, let me give you a little bit of my background and why I've discovered this is difficult. Anybody here ever worked for a Japanese company or for a Japanese customer? You've probably all experienced this. The differences between yes and no can be subtle. I've worked for the past 3 years for Mitsui Sumitomo Insurance Group. They're based in Tokyo, and I've been in charge of their strategic planning, their project management, basically like a PMO combined with a corporate planning office here in the U.S. They've got about 300 people here in the U.S. and quite a few Japanese staff who cycle through every 2 to 5 years. So it's almost like we have a little piece of Tokyo here in New Jersey cycling through the MSIG USA offices. It's made for the most interesting cultural experiments I've ever been involved with. So I want to share some of that with you here today, and hopefully you'll find that enlightening and useful when you're dealing with cross-cultural issues. Specifically, I'm going to talk about our new project startup process, charter, how that works, and how we overcome some of the miscommunication. Now, what does yes mean? In classic business English, it usually means I agree, you have my complete support, or you have my authorization. It means yes. It means we have agreement on this. It means you can go out and spend money. It means the new project has been started. But I'm going to tell you a story about two fictional Japanese business people. We're going to have Tanaka-san. Tanaka is a regular business employee, and he has a manager, Koike-san. Tanaka-san comes up and he says, we have a problem. I need to tell you about this I have a very, very serious issue, and I think I have the correct solution for it. In fact, I'm sure this is the right solution. In this conversation, Koike-san will almost certainly be saying one word. That word is hai. The word hai in Japanese, roughly translated into English, is yes. It sounds almost insane to a U.S. audience. It sounds like Koike is trying to rush his associate along and just say yes, yes, all through the conversation, yes, yes. Now, an American listening to this conversation would say, does this person have authority to go out and start this project? Of course they do. Koike-san was so excited about the idea, he just kept saying yes over and over again. He barely let the man finish. But in truth, what yes usually means in a Japanese situation is, I heard you. Yes, I was listening. It doesn't mean that Tanaka-san has any authority to move ahead. Now, this caused enormous problems and confusion in our U.S. office. What we have very often are Japanese higher executives who are at our chairman level, representatives in charge of marketing and so on, with a lot of power and a lot of authority in the company. Most of the staff, though, is U.S. So very often, somebody from the U.S. would come up to our chairman or another senior executive and say, I've got this idea, I've got this problem, what do you want to do about this? And the Japanese business people, if they understand there's a difference between yes and hi. They tend not to say yes, but they're very positive about the idea. It's hard to get that out of your system. They're very enthusiastic about the idea. And the U.S. people would assume they've got authority to proceed. They'd assume the project has been authorized. So they say, hey, we've got this big problem. And, you know, the Japanese projector would be nodding his head enthusiastically. Say, okay, so we're going to do this, right? And they'd be like, yes. And they just say, whoa, we got an agreement. Off the American would go. This is a disaster. Because very often, all the Japanese person is trying to be is polite. It was just trying to follow normal Japanese protocol, which is you say yes to verify that you have in fact heard the person. So what we really need as project managers is not just to hear the word yes. That's not enough. We need to know what does the person mean by yes. And this is going to trip us up if we don't get this right. These are the kinds of problems we would experience as U.S. staff when we took that high for a real true yes. We would have situations where project managers would go off to start new projects. They would assemble teams. They would start giving orders to people, assuming that they had the full support and blessing of our chairman or other senior executives. In fact, they didn't. How hard is it to start a project when you have no support? We've all done that, right? You have no power, no authority, right? How much worse is it when you think you have full and complete authority, and in fact you have none? You don't discover it until 2 months later when the chairman comes over and taps you on the shoulder and says, what are you doing? Not a good situation. What you really need is the ability for executives to delegate project delivery to somebody in the organization, and to do it with confidence, and to do it with clarity. Cultural issues can make this very, very difficult. Part of the whole purpose of our project chartering process is to make these issues clear. So these are the things I'm going to run through today. I'm going to start out with a few definitions, go into how project charters really bridge cultural issues in our company, then go on to how we authorize a project. I'm going to share with you the specific process as to how we go step by step to create that full and complete and unambiguous authority for a new project. Then I'm going to talk about how we negotiate, how handy this is when we're in a negotiating situation as a project manager, and finally talk some about organizational maturity. Now, I know some of the speakers have stopped at the end for questions. I like taking questions in the middle. If you have questions, just put your hand up. We're going to have someone bring a microphone over to you, and you can take questions that way. So don't wait for the end with a question. Jump right in. I also want to note for everybody, we are recording this, so if you don't like the idea of being recorded, be very quiet. So what is a project charter? And the first thing, this is all straight from your PMBOK. It's got to be issued by the project sponsor. It has to provide authority to the project manager. Now, I'll do a quick poll here. Who thinks that they have a charter for most or all of their projects? Everybody who's got their hand down, unless you don't do project management, you are wrong. You have a charter. Somewhere, somehow, somebody with enough power to say this project exists and you're in charge, they've done that. It doesn't matter how light or informal that communication might have been, in my view, that's a project charter. If you read in PMBOK, there's a number of different items that they say ought to be in a project charter. Return on investment, business case, other issues like that. Those aren't the key things. This is the key item. Authority, authority, authority. Has someone given you authority to be the project manager? Now, a lot of people would say, especially with the PMBOK definition, this has to be delivered in writing. This has to be a documented piece of paper saying who has authority to do what. In my opinion, though, if an executive, if my chairman comes up to me in the hallway and says, Alex, I need you to form a team and get a new marketing plan put together, that's all the charter I need. I'm not going to sit down to him and say, you know what, if that's not in writing, I can't accept it. Not a good career step. If I really want to do a good job as a project manager, I'd certainly recommend take that conversation, put it in writing, mail it back to him and say, I want to make sure I understand this correctly. And then if they send back, I agree, that's a much better charter. You've got it in writing. But either way, you've got authority to proceed. That's the key concept with a project charter. So your charter can be very short. I've got charters on file for some of our projects that are two sentences long. They describe what we need to do. They describe who's the project manager and who's the sponsor. That's really the key elements of it. All right, so now, I want to jump back to the issues of culture, because that's really the focus. That's the interesting thing to me about what we've had to work through here. Why is this so important towards bridging these cultural gaps? Well, what we do is we take this proposal, and this is before it's been authorized. We write down details about how this project is going to work, not what activities are going to be in it, but what its basic objectives are, what the basic business need is. And we write these in a style that is clearly for the senior executives. We have a chief claims officer, a chief operations officer, chief information officer. We're really writing to those people as an audience. So this tends to be a very, very, very short doc, 2 to 3 pages. And actually, we heard some jokes up here before about how the higher you go up in the chain, the less you're able to understand things. Well, I give my senior executives a little more generous view. I found that the more you go up, the less time you have to read. That's really what I've seen most often with my senior executives. So they need it short, they need it to the point. So what we do is we take this proposal, we bring it to a committee. This committee is typically made up of both U.S. and Japanese representatives. So it actually gives people a chance to work out any of these differences of opinion. And I've gotten questions before, why a committee? Is this some special Japanese issue that it has to be decided as a group? That's kind of a stereotype and not particularly correct. Actually, our Japanese chairman recently said, I don't want committees anymore. I'm in charge. I make these decisions. So there can be various decisions and recommendations that go on the document before it gets to his desk. But at the end of the day, he's in charge and he makes those choices. So this has gone through a number of changes over the past 3 years. And overall, this basic process has really helped us a lot. So after discussion, the charter is either approved or rejected. Now this is the key to the process. We're getting a definite answer. Is this a yes or is this a no? And what this has done is really eliminate those questions and uncertainty. So you know, go back to the hallway conversation. I go up to the chairman, say, I've got an idea, I've got a problem, I want to start a project. If he just says yes, he may just be saying, yes, I'm listening to you, but no, that's a terrible idea. That's not uncommon. But if we're sitting in a committee meeting, and we have written out in front of us a proposal, and it describes the same project that I just brought to him informally, we can actually have a meeting where we sit down and say, let's answer your questions about this, and now at the end of the meeting, let's have a vote. Let's have a decision as to whether this moves forward or not. Now, this is a very Japanese tradition that you see, and I was very unfamiliar with this when I first started. I was used to U.S. type decision-making groups, where you get a lot of conversation, you get a lot of back and forth, a certain amount of debate. And that's, I saw a lot of those same patterns in the first proposals I brought before the senior executive. And usually at the very end of it, everybody would look towards the most senior person in the room, and that person would come up with an answer, yes or no. That's the kind of decision-making style I was most used to. What was interesting would happen, and this is very typical in a Japanese company, is we would have a discussion, and it would be animated. People would definitely have different opinions about this. And at some point, a silence would settle over the room. And we would wait. We would just look around at each other. Sometimes they call this in Japanese, letting the solution emerge from the silence. And it's not comfortable if you're from the U.S. You're sitting there looking at the president, looking at the CEO, looking at a couple of other chief officers of the company. You're saying, why are we sitting here looking at each other? But my boss at the time, who's been working in this environment for about 15 years, he understood what was going on. He let the silence continue for a while, and he says, does anybody feel this should proceed, or does anybody feel that this we should stop this? And then someone would venture an opinion and say, yes, I agree with this. Might be a little more silence, but slowly we get the votes from around the room. It's a very different decision-making style. But the one merit that I've seen out of it is you really know whether the decision is yes or no. We'll get more into some of the aspects of that in just a second. Now, I've asked our Japanese staff about why they like this process, because they really do like this. I think they found this is a big improvement over the hallway conversation. And a key thing is, in the hallway conversation, it was very, very hard for them to understand what was being asked. Now, this is no poor reflection on their English skills. They have excellent English skills. Some of them have better vocabulary. All right, can you speak loud? All right, speak up. This is interesting. The question is, would we put a different charter together to bridge cultural gaps than just a regular charter? I found that putting together the right charter is completely dependent on your senior executives and decision makers and what they need to know to make a decision as to whether this is a go project or a no-go project. How are they going to decide yes or no? So I don't think it's so much a cultural issue as much as it is understanding your executive decision makers. And I'll be getting to the various information that we do collect for our charters in depth. So what they found, though, was that they would get this information in a hallway conversation. And one of the pieces of information that was said here today, the project is DOA. Everybody here know what DOA means? Anybody here know what Hajimemashite means? We got one. You also knew what DOA meant, right? Yeah, dead on arrival. They would have a great idea about what maybe perspicacity meant. They had excellent vocabulary, but we'd throw in jargon and sports metaphors that would leave them completely flummoxed. They had no idea what we were talking about. And we said, DOA, the handoff, we're going to pass this up the line, we're going to pass this down the line. It would cause them a lot of difficulty. What we found is when we put this in writing, first of all, the American staff would tend to get rid of a lot of their jargon. They would get rid of a lot of their acronyms, or they would spell things out. That was very helpful to the Japanese. The other thing is that the Japanese could help each other with the English words. There's a lot of ambiguous words in English that could be translated a few different ways into Japanese. So we'd see them sometimes look at a document, confer with each other, and then they'd be like, oh, okay, now I understand, because they'd agree on which type of translation is most appropriate for this particular situation. They also found it was helpful because they could read these at their own pace and in their own time. If you were trying to read a Japanese business proposal and it was being presented at you at the beginning of a meeting, everybody's talking Japanese in the middle and you're supposed to come up with a decision on it, very, very hard. But if you've got a few days ahead of time to translate, go through the dictionary, look up, ask questions, it's a much, much more successful meeting. The other thing that they enjoyed was the fact that this gave us the ability to have formal meetings. It gave us the opportunity to have real discussion around the pros and cons of this situation. So they're not just submitted a document and said, what do you think, yes or no? They're given a chance to confer and discuss and come up with ideas. Now, what did this do for the U.S. staff? Well, you could be cynical and say it meant a lot more work for the U.S. staff, because we actually had to write down everything we wanted. We couldn't just Shanghai the chairman in the corner and say, you like this idea, right? That's a lot easier. But what it did, though, is it gave us a good official decision. So when that charter came out of the process and it was marked approved, we knew that that was a decision that was going to stick. Part of my job is to date stamp these things and keep a record of who approved what when. Our internal audit people love me. They have all these records of this type of information. But it's very helpful for the U.S. staff as well, because they know they have someplace they can go and find out that that wasn't just a yes, I hear you. That was a yes, I agree and authorize this payment. So it managed to remove a lot of the misunderstanding and create a better environment for us. So this goes back to the question we had over here. What goes into the charter? And would we put together a different charter if we were trying to bridge cultures versus we're trying to achieve some other end? This is our list of information. I'm not going to read it off, but it's very short, very basic. We want to make sure that every project has a title. We want to make sure that every project has a project manager and a sponsor assigned. We're looking for a basic overview of the project. But at this point, it's just an idea. It's not yet something that's been planned out in any detail. We're not going to have work packages. We're not going to have earned value reports yet. The integrated baseline meetings have not been held. This is just a figment of an idea in somebody's head. But we want to get it on paper, and we want to get it out to see if this is something we should proceed with. Is it worth the money even to plan this? So once we have that information, we then start working it through the process. And this is our basic process. We have ideas. Now, I love this about our company. Any person in the company can come up with an idea. Whether they're a chief executive officer, or whether they're a person who's in our operations department, even somebody who's a temp or a consultant, if they have an idea that they think would improve our company in some way, they can take that idea, come and speak with me, we'll put together one of these opportunity documents. One completed opportunity document is usually about 2 or 3 pages. Any longer than that, and I'm going to start telling people you're putting too much detail in. Let's put in some attachments, maybe a business case that's going to carry forward to our project plan. But something that's short and sweet. If somebody understands their idea well, it usually takes them about 30 minutes to 1 hour to sit down and document it. Very, very lightweight. I've actually run into some people who say, I worked on this and it took weeks to get the opportunity document done. I always ask them this question. I say, did you know what you wanted when you started writing? Or did you have to figure it out in the middle? People who it takes 2 weeks to get the thing done, they usually didn't really understand what they wanted at the start. It's a very helpful process. After we get that opportunity document, this is written in business language, it's clear enough that people can make a decision pretty swiftly about it. I might say, we're going to train 20 of our staff in project management techniques for $10,000 over the course of 4 weeks. And it's just a nice, straightforward statement like that, that we can take to one of our chief officers and say, do you agree with this? Do you want to have this happen in your department? Is this worthwhile? If they give the green light to it, then we may have other levels of approvals that go through. It depends on the department and who it's affecting. But then we bring that to the executive committee, or the way the process is now, we bring it to our chairman. And he makes the final decision to say, is this project authorized or not authorized? Assuming that it is, it's approved, the opportunity now becomes a project, and that approved document is truly what you'd see in the PMBOK as being a project charter. It really meets all the definitions at that point. It's got the project manager assigned. We've usually recommended one before it got to the chairman, but sometimes the chairman will say, no, I don't want to have that person run that effort. I want to have somebody else run it. And interestingly, we go back and forth. We have both Japanese and American staff serving in project manager roles. So it's really bridging cultures that way as well. So what does this charter do for us? Why is this important? Why do we get value out of this? The key thing is, it answers that question, who gave you the authority? I'll tell you, there is no better answer to the question, who gave you that authority, than the chairman. I mean, who's going to trump that? Unless you travel over to Tokyo and get his boss out here, there's really no way to trump that. And if any of you have done business with Tokyo, you know with the time difference, you can't get them on the phone, ever. That's very hard to override that, and it's never happened. They also answer the question, how much authority did you get? What have you been authorized to do? We've got at least a summary explanation of what this project is, and we know that that was agreed to. The other key thing about getting this in writing that's so valuable in our company, we go through various stages of approval. Having the document in writing means that everybody saw the same document the same way. It always started with the same words, the same sentences, and we know that everybody signed off on that. Of course, there are sometimes disagreements over what was meant by certain language, but as soon as we get disagreements around that, we know who we need to talk to. Whoever signed it at the bottom, and we can resolve it. It's key. They also answer questions for negotiators. Why is this important? Well, best answer again, because the chairman said it was important. And of course, we don't leave it just at that. We have business goals. We have medium-term plans and long-term plans, which honestly, not everybody in the company will understand or hear all the changes that go into that. But part of my job in strategic planning is to say, this is what's going on with us short-term, medium-term, and long-term as a company, and this is how the project fits into that. And I usually try and capture a little spirit of that in the opportunity document itself, and I help people write those. So if you have a good negotiator, they're going to ask you these questions. They're going to want to know, before they give you their best operations person, before they release that SME that you really want, they're going to want to know what are the answers to these questions. Very often, even a novice project manager can get past those negotiations because they've got a two-page piece of paper that they hold up and they say, see? It works really, really well. So these are some of our negotiating obstacles. You've probably heard of the title, Getting to Yes. I don't think that would be a very interesting title in Japan. As I've said before, it's very easy to get to yes. It's almost too easy. All you have to do is say something that's more than a couple of sentences long, and chances are the business person on the other side is going to be saying, hi, hi, yes. What you really have trouble getting to in Japan is no. It's hard to figure out if something has really been rejected yet. And this process helps us with that. And this is a kind of a lesson that I've learned, not only from dealing with people from Russia, but dealing with people from, I'm sorry, not only from people from Japan, but also people from Russia, people from India. A lot of cultures have a real problem with direct confrontation, particularly when there's unequal authority between the two people involved. So people will be reluctant to say no, or that's a bad idea. In the U.S., I think we're relatively free to say that, even to somebody who's above us. But what you see most often in Japan is a desire to save face. So what I've had to learn is that if I come up with a good project idea, something I think is really important, I may bring it before a group or a committee, and I may get the answer after that long silence that I talked about before, this is a very good idea. We need to consider this further. Let's discuss this again next week. What that means is no. At least for now, that means no. And I've learned that it really pays sometimes to ask clarifying questions, to say, well, if we don't start this week, you understand we're going to have these difficulties. There's going to be a problem getting certain resources. Maybe we're going to have to drop a contract on a consultant. We have no guarantee we're going to get the same quality of people if we don't make that decision this week. And what you'll very often get as an answer is, yes, I understand. That doesn't mean hire the consultant. That doesn't mean you have any authority. That means this is going to wait till next week. Sometimes that means that this is really a dead project. This is something they have no interest in pursuing. But it's rare to get that kind of an honest, frank answer in the meeting itself. Very often you'll get a, let's wait until later answer. And then after the meeting, in a one-on-one situation, you can sit down with the key decision makers and truly get an answer that this is something that just doesn't make sense for the company right now, and we should drop this. But what's key in Japan is saving face and giving respect to the people involved. Now, if I brought that suggestion in front of the group, if they had looked at me and said, that is a terrible idea, I've had U.S. bosses say that kind of thing to me. I'm not saying I normally have terrible ideas. But there are times where I've either seen them do this to me, do this to others, and say, how could you have come up with something like that? You're wasting our time here. Don't give us these kinds of ideas in the meeting. You're following the wrong protocol. All sorts of things, which frankly are pretty offensive. And I don't recommend doing that in any cultural situation. But in Japan, it's key to save face. And by saying, let's consider this next week, we're able to say, this is a wonderful idea, but it's not something we're going to proceed with right now. And I'm saved any kind of embarrassment. Did you have a comment or a question? Oh, just talking about the face. Yep. Very important.
I have a question.
Yeah, one more question?
Yeah. You were talking about, you know, there is a delay. When you're in a meeting, there's a delay, and they don't answer, you know, the question, and there's the long silence, you know, the question and the long silence and the decision. Do you find that seems to be the case because, you know, you're American project managers and then they're Japanese, so they need the time to think, versus if they were in Japan with, you know, all Japanese, you know, committee members, a Japanese project manager, the same culture, would that then make them make a decision faster versus the delay?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So would, if we were in Japan dealing with an all Japanese group, would we have that same delay? And I obviously can't speak for that personally because I'm always the American in the room when I'm actually there. And believe it or not, that really does change things. Even if I say nothing, I'm the American in the room and I believe they'll behave a little differently. But I've certainly heard from people who either have studied Japanese culture and also for my friends who are Japanese representatives, that this is not an unusual way to make a decision. In fact, there was an educational video that I saw where they had a father and a son in Japan, and the father runs a rice farm, and the son is interested in going to Tokyo and pursuing an education, making more money. But as the eldest son, he has an obligation to remain on the farm. So he actually brings this situation to his father, and this is a very serious situation. Who's going to run the farm after he leaves? Can he even go to Tokyo? Is he going to be allowed to do this? So the two of them sit down before a center area the father is sitting there, the son sits down next to him, respectfully waits for the father to initiate the conversation, and then explains the situation. And the two of them sit there for about a minute and a half before either of them says another word. The father doesn't reply at all. And I think it really is a show of respect. It's a way the father can say that he's really considering this very, very seriously and understands it is a serious issue. And I don't remember in the educational thing what happens to the son. I think he does go off to Tokyo. Yeah, we have another question?
What is the role of translating the service within the tribe? Do you use it?
Yeah, this is a good question about translation services. I am always awed by the English capability of our Japanese representatives. I think there's a lot of English in Japan. There's a lot of emphasis on having good English skills in school. And certainly every representative that comes over here has very good written English skills and variable oral written skills. So usually we don't translate documents like these into Japanese. But if we ever do need to, and sometimes we do, sometimes our home office representatives who do not actually have great English skills, they've never been cycled through to the U.S., sometimes they need copies of this. And then I usually work with a gentleman by the name Kenji Usami. He's kind of my counterpart on the Japanese side. And he and I will iron out any questions of translation. His English is quite good, and I'm trying to learn a little bit of Japanese, but I'm nowhere near as skilled as he is in English. But I can answer questions about what's meant by certain words, and he's able to then come up with an accurate translation. All right, do you have any other questions? This is great. Thank you guys all for asking questions, by the way. A lot of times I just go on and on, but it's good to get some feedback. All right, let's get to the next slide. All right, now, I want to talk some about organizational maturity and the role of charters in here. Because while we're bridging these cultural issues, I am firmly believing that we are also helping our project management capabilities. So if any of you deal with, I don't know, CMM, what's another good one? There's a TMMM, OPM3. Anybody go through any of those sorts of maturity assessments? We have a handful of people. That's good. If you have a good, solid charter process, if you have a clear process for starting up new projects, you have set the foundation for all sorts of other mature project management processes. Now, when we talk about maturity, usually the key thing that they're looking at is repeatability and improvement. So can you repeat similar processes over and over again consistently in your organization? For us, we have written policies and procedures that describe how projects start. If something doesn't follow that procedure, it's not on my list, it's not a project in our company. It's quite strict. But at the same time, it's very short. We kept these policies and procedures quite short, and that's fine as far as organizational maturity models are concerned. They can be short policies and procedures. They can be simple. The key thing is that everybody follows them, and there's some control around them. What we also do with these policies and procedures is we've given us the ability to insert new requirements. We were challenged by our internal audit committee. They said, well, this is great. You have your list of projects. How do they tie into our organizational goals? How do they affect our vision, our mission, our strategic plan? At first, I couldn't give them a good answer to that question. So what I did is I added another step to our procedures that said, okay, what you have to do is compare the opportunity, the proposal, to our medium-term and long-term business plan, which also tie back to the medium-term and long-term plans of Tokyo, and make sure that this project is somehow aligned with them. If it's not, specify that it's not. If it is, specify how it is. I was doing that informally before internal audits asked for it, but I was actually able to now point to something in a line in the policy and procedure that says, we do this, and we do this consistently. The other thing that we do that's really key around this, if you want to have a nice, clear, auditable, defendable process around your project, you need to have a clear sense of who authorized what when. That's just so fundamental to any sort of internal audit, SOX, maturity models, any of these issues. You need to know who gave authority and how much authority. If you're not authorizing the projects to begin with, it's like trying to control a flow of water without knowing where the water comes from. If you can't control what projects there are in your company, how they're begun, if you're just trying to control who gets assigned or what their budgets are, you're always going to have problems. You're always going to be playing catch-up. We found by starting with charters, by getting good control over project charters, we were really able to control a lot of the future processes, things like budgeting and scheduling, much, much better. It provided a great foundation. So what we get out of that formal process, and the key thing is, this is what a lot of our executives like about this, we come to them with an idea before we've really spent any money on it. I think the greatest tragedy in the minds of most senior executives is that project that you've invested a lot of time and energy in, but it was a terrible, terrible idea to begin with. And then they have to kill it. It's very unpleasant. It reflects poorly on the people who were working on the project, the people who came up with the idea. It reflects poorly on the senior executive. We've had to have situations like that. It's embarrassing all around. What if you turn that around? How do you prevent that from happening in the first place? But you could say that it's a nuisance, because we're going to bring a lot of ideas up to our senior managers. But the only reliable way is bring these ideas to them very, very, very early. We bring them ideas before we have a schedule, before we have a budget, before we've done any real estimating, just to see if this is a good idea. And it doesn't take them long to make a decision because there's not a lot of information about it yet. But at the same time, it does provide a check. So if it's a really bad idea, it won't even get into the planning phase. We've also got, like I said, the clarity, well documented. I can point to emails, I can point to processes to say, this is what we do, this is how we do it. Our audit people really like this. We're now starting to go through some SOX compliance issues. We're actually not traded on the US stock exchanges, so we don't have to comply with SOX at this point. But there's moves to have a Japanese version of SOX. And there could be some days where we do need to comply with SOX. We're starting to look at those issues. Well, our auditors have said, this process is a key control. Now, what do you think that does to you in terms of job stability? It's great. Doesn't mean I have to keep doing the job. I can train someone else to do it someday. But it probably does mean that there'll be some form of a strategic planning office in our company for a long time to come. You can also make sure that your portfolio of projects is well balanced and prioritized. Very often when we come up with a new project idea, a new proposal, our executives want to say, well, what do we currently have going now? Does this make sense in the context of the other things we're trying to do? It gives them a great chance to make those decisions again before we have invested a lot of time and energy, very early in the process. So this is really where the cultural differences come into play. We found that the more we can have a concrete written definition of what we're doing, the easier it is. Now, you imagine if you have a US group and a Japanese group. They're very, very different in terms of their perspective, in terms of what they think is important. Our Japanese representatives, many of them have started to read English newspapers, but they're also highly in touch with the Tokyo world. Probably most of you have never heard of Mitsui Sumitomo Insurance. But it's the number two property and casualty insurer in Japan. They just have a different mindset. Different names cause key triggers. Well, we share Toyota and Sony now, but it's a different view. Then we've got our U.S. group. Again, very different view. They know the 50 states and the District of Columbia. They're very familiar with the U.S. insurance market. But how do we bring them together? How do we create some consistency? Well, we've almost created a third culture in a way. We've created this culture of project management and strategic planning so that we have written procedures that say, this is how you create a project. I've had Japanese staff go through that process. I've had many American staff go through that process. It's something that we have that can be shared, that can be understood by everybody. And it really, I believe, helps keep everybody working together in a healthy, productive way. Any of them can look and see the same list of project charters to see everything that's going on in the company project-wise. Very, very helpful to get everybody on the same page. In fact, a lot of those documents get translated and sent to Tokyo so that the people who are overseeing our work in Tokyo can be on the same page with us. So the last thing, of course, and I've said this before, but it's just so important, with the formal sign-offs, we eliminated a lot of misunderstanding. And I want to give you a caveat, though. Anybody here dealing with China or any other country that doesn't deal so much necessarily with contracts the way we do? We have a couple of people out there. Japan shares something with the U.S., very heavy emphasis on contracts and written deliverables and agreements. Not all cultures share that. I purposely created a lot of these policies and procedures to take advantage of some of the common elements that we had in terms of culture and agreement. But I've heard from working with other people who are in China that the written contract is just the beginning of the negotiation. It's not the end. Here in the U.S. or in Japan, typically the written contract is the final stage of the negotiation. So you can't just take this process and throw it into any situation and expect it to work with the culture. What you really have to do is keep your eyes open, keep your ears open, and understand the issues that are involved with your types of teams and adapt some of these ideas to something that makes sense and that works well for you. All right, so come back to this question. When does yes mean yes, you have authority? Not yes, I'm listening. Not yes, it's nice to hear you speak, but you have authority. You have the right to manage this project. Well, what we've done is create a situation where we now know when yes means yes. It means yes when we have a charter, it's been approved by the right people on the right date, and we have it in the storehouse on our intranet. Anybody in our company can go and look at that intranet and see what's been approved and what hasn't. And if they're not sure, they all have my telephone number, they call me up and ask. This works really, really well. I think that any organization, and it really doesn't matter what your cultural issues are, even if everybody in your company is from Newark, New Jersey, and they all share exactly the same culture, if you can shore up your policies and procedures around charters, I think it's going to be a benefit to you. But if you do have cultural differences, I think almost all of us do, even if we're all living in the same state, a lot of us are from different countries. Well, these kinds of improvements, I think, will have even more benefits because we're going to have those differences in communication, because we're going to have those differences in decision-making style. What I want you to do is not just think about hearing yes and assuming you have the right to run. What I want you to do is think about hearing yes, asking a few more questions, saying, okay, so we both have the same understanding here. So we are authorizing this to move forward. So we are committing $100,000 of the company's money to this initiative. And hearing yes, yes, yes to questions like that. Even better is, yes, I agree with you and I authorize that. Very, very helpful. One last question here. Yeah, there's informal brainstorming. this is very common in a Japanese company. A lot of informal communication, as you were talking about, where does that come in? That typically comes in before the authorization happens. So we'll do a lot of brainstorming to come up with the ideas, to come up with the proposals. But once it's moving along the process to be approved, it tends to get much more formal. And that's really what I've been talking about here, is more that formal step towards the end. But we do brainstorming, we do a lot of work to try and get ideas, particularly at the end of projects, to get new ideas to start up. So I hope you guys all, I'll take more questions afterwards. I don't want to keep everybody here after time. We've got a break coming up.
Thank you very much, Alec, for presenting this to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.